With infinite complacence, people went to and fro over the earth about their little affairs, serene in the assurance of their dominion over this small, spinning fragment of solar driftwood, which by chance or design, man has inherited out of the dark mystery of time and space.
Why don't you ask me what it feels like to be a freak?
Greetings, you are listening to Savage Science Radio here at Jackalope 105 FM, and I am your host, Tracy Savage. Let's have some great tunes to start tonight off. Starting off with three news in brief, molecules, matter, and energy. Tiny, teeny chips are on the menu, a computer processor barely visible to the human eye that can perform many of the logic operations larger computer chips do, is reported in the February 10th issue of Nature. The device, developed by scientists at Harvard University, contains about 500 transistors made from synthesized nanowires. It's an order of magnitude more complex than any previous nanoprocessor, they say, and is scalable, allowing modules to be connected to each other to potentially develop tiny, low-power nanocontrollers for miniature robots or medical devices. Check that out in February 10th issue of Nature. Now, you want to get that nicotine fix? Well, knocking out a molecule in rats' brains help explain why some people find it especially hard to quit smoking. In both people and rodents, molecules on cells in part of the brain called the habenula sense nicotine. Usually, after a certain amount of nicotine in the habenula sends a "we've had enough" signal, but in rats with altered nicotine-sensing molecules, this signal got scrambled, and the rodents self-administered whopping doses of nicotine far beyond what normal rats would want, finds a study appearing in online journal January 30th issue of Nature. People with mutations in the gene encoding this same molecule are more vulnerable to tobacco addiction. And in this new study led by Paul Kenny at the Scripps Research Institute in Jupiter, Florida, may help explain why. And third on the menu, not your ordinary water. For anyone who's ever wanted to build a teeny tiny water park, beware. On the nanoscale, water doesn't follow the rules. In big containers, think buckets or oceans, water molecules bounce off each other and stick together through hydrogen bonds, which are small electromagnetic pushes and pulls going on. But in very small containers, water molecules rewire their electricity, researchers from the University of Houston report online at arxiv.org. Confined in tubes about 20 helium atoms across, protons and water molecules wiggle in entirely different ways. Channels this small are common in the cell, so studies of water in extremely small containers may help scientists to understand how liquids behave in living organisms. Boy, is there a whole bunch of biology in the news this week. Some stem cells are holding on to their past, researchers say. Stem cells made from mature cells and rewound to an embryonic-like state retain a distant memory of their past that might limit their potential for therapeutic use, scientists reported February 2nd in the journal Nature. In a side-by-side comparison of these induced pluripotent stem cells and embryonic stem cells, researchers from the Salk Institute in San Diego found a consistent pattern of reprogramming errors, places where the iPS cells did not revert completely to an embryonic state. Definitively demonstrates that there are differences between the two cell types, said Joseph Wu, a stem cell biologist at the Stanford University School of Medicine, who was not involved in this research. Knowing exactly what those differences are is a key step in developing ways to use iPS cells to treat diseases, experts said. Most researchers still consider embryonic stem cells to be the gold standard for regenerative medicine because they can grow into any type of cell in the body. But many scientists and policymakers would like to see the treatments based on iPS cells because they can be made without destroying embryos, hence the controversy. In addition, iPS cells can be custom made for patients, ensuring a perfect genetic match. Now, to catalog the difference between the two cell types, the Salk team, led by molecular biologist Joseph Ecker, studied the epigenomes. These are chemical markers attached to the DNA that regulate the way genes dial on and off, and they did this to 11 different cell lines. They looked at 1.2 billion places in each genome where such chemical markers exist. The analysis was unusually rigorous and therefore unusually revealing, Ecker said. Earlier studies examined representative regions of in the genome rather than the whole thing. Now, up to this point, people were looking through a keyhole, he said, but we're opening up the door. Now, for the most part, the contents of Ecker's metaphorical rooms looked alike, but when they zoomed in, inconsistencies emerged. Large regions of the iPS epigenomes hadn't reverted to the embryonic state, but instead held on to the epigenetic memory of their tissue of origin. When the researchers used the iPS cells to create mature cells in the lab, this memory persisted. The regions were clustered near telomeres and centromeres, which are structures that help direct how chromosomes divide. Now, there's something about these regions that make it harder to modulate the epigenome, Ecker said. In some ways, the iPS cells were different from one another, suggesting the reprogramming process itself might contribute to the aberrations, he added. That does not mean iPS cells can't be used in medicine, experts said. Improvements in technology could one day erase their epigenetic memory. In addition, Wu said, scientists might find ways to harness that epigenetic memory to help treat disease. For example, if heart cells generated from iPS cells retain some of their cardiac characteristics, he suggested, they might be useful in therapies to treat heart disease. We need to do more research to see exactly what this means, he said. Again, you can find that in the February 2nd issue of Nature. Got a broken heart? This little fish can help mend it. Fish that regrow cardiac tissue could mend human hearts. Scientists hope to end heart transplant surgery forever with the help of the amazing zebra fish, a miracle fish that lives in the Ganges River, the holiest of all rivers to Hindus, could help cure heart disease and forever end the need for heart transplant surgery, according to The Independent. Zebra fish are tiny tropical fish with a superpower. They can regenerate damaged cardiac tissue at an incredible rate. In a week, a zebra fish can repair as much as 20% of its heart muscle. Now, medical researchers working with the British Heart Foundation hope that insight into the fish's ability could lead to the development of new treatments that will one day allow the human heart to heal itself. Scientifically, mending human hearts is an achievable goal, and we really could make recovering from a heart attack as simple as getting over a broken leg, Peter Weisberg, medical director of the British Heart Foundation, told The Independent. There are significant differences between the structure of the zebrafish heart and the human heart, but there are enough similarities to make such a breakthrough possible. For example, the hearts of zebrafish have only two chambers compared to the four found in human hearts, but the human heart also contains a significant number of latent stem cells that could be stimulated to regenerate cardiac tissue, just as a zebra heart does. We have a burgeoning epidemic of heart failure, and we know that the zebrafish is able to regenerate its heart muscle to an extraordinary extent. There's a biological trick there that we need to learn from and adapt to human beings, Weisberg said. Now, scientists have already uncovered a key molecule central to the zebrafish's biological trick. Zebrafish hearts contain a protein called thymosin beta 4, which seems to trigger the growth of the epicardium membrane that surrounds the heart. New heart-repairing drugs based on this protein are already being researched. Although the development of this technology won't end the onset of heart disease itself, only a healthy diet and lifestyle can do that, it nevertheless offers hope that heart disease sufferers can eventually make a full recovery. It could also end the need for heart transplant surgery by enabling a heart attack survivor to regenerate the damaged cells. Since heart disease is the leading cause of death in the U.S., such a breakthrough could save hundreds of thousands of lives every year in America alone. Who would have thought that such a big problem could be solved by such a tiny fish?
Into the dark, I struggle to find my way as
And in even more biology news, scientists grow blood vessels for human surgery. Oh yes, it's true. The process involves taking smooth muscle cells from a human cadaver and grafting them onto tubes made of the material used in making dissolvable stitches called polyglycolic acid. Within 8 to 10 weeks, the tubes degrade and a fully formed vascular graft remains. And this was from the research by scientists from Duke University, East Carolina University, and Yale University. The veins have been tested in baboons and dogs. They were not rejected by the animals' bodies and functioned well for 6 months, said the study published in the journal Science Translational Medicine. Now, the bioengineered vessels could also be stored in saline solution for up to a year, suggesting that one day surgeons could pluck a vein off the shelf for use in a sick patient, the study said. These can be made ahead of time and then are ready to go whenever they are needed, the paper said. Clinical trials in humans are expected to begin soon, according to a spokeswoman from Humacyte, a regenerative medicine company based in North Carolina that also contributed to the study and funded the research. Currently, grafting the patient's own veins remains the gold standard, said co-author Alan Kypson of the Brody School of Medicine in East Carolina University. But harvesting a vein from the patient's leg can lead to complications, and for patients who don't have suitable veins, the bioengineered veins could serve as an important new way to provide a coronary bypass. The engineered vessels have also decreased potential for infection, obstruction, or clotting, the study noted. Now, Shannon Dahl, Senior Director of Scientific Operations at Humacyte, said the veins can be made in a variety of sizes for use in different operations. We can make the bioengineered veins in large and small diameter, which means they can be used for procedures ranging from hemodialysis for patients with kidney failure and also for coronary bypass, she said. The National Kidney Foundation says that 320,000 patients require dialysis, and more than half of dialysis patients lack the healthy veins necessary and must undergo an arterial venous graft, an AV graft, placement for the procedure. Around 400,000 coronary bypass procedures are performed annually in the United States, according to the American Heart Association. Wow, lots of cardiac information in the biological news this week. And zinc can be an effective treatment for common colds. A review of the available scientific evidence suggests that taking zinc within a day of the onset of cold symptoms speeds recovery and may also help ward off colds, say the authors of Cochrane's systematic review that included data from 15 trials involving 1,360 people. They say zinc cannot be used in long term because of toxicity concerns. Yes, excessive amounts can cause nausea, vomiting, abdominal pain, and diarrhea. Yay. Now, more work is needed to determine the exact dosing required, say the experts. Adults catch between 2 and 4 colds a year, and children up to 10 a year. There's little a person can do to avoid these infections because the viruses responsible are so commonplace. Cold viruses can be passed from person to person not only by coughs and sneezes, but also by touching contaminated surfaces, such as door handles. Ew. Now, there is no proven treatment for the common cold, we know this, but experts believe zinc medications may help prevent and lessen infections by coating the common cold viruses and stopping them from entering the body through the lining of the nose. It also appears to stop the virus from replicating, at least, well, in laboratory tests anyway. There is also the suggestion that zinc aids the immune system, as has been said for some time by a lot of people, and may dampen down some of the unpleasant reactions the body has to an invading virus. Lead researcher Meenu Singh of the Postgraduate Institute of Medical Education and Research in Chandigarh, India, said, "This review strengthens the evidence for zinc as a treatment for the common cold. However, at the moment, it is still difficult to make a general recommendation because we do not know very much about the optimum dose, formulation, or length of treatment." Unquote. According to trial results, resulting in these trials, zinc syrup, lozenges, or tablets taken within a day of the onset of cold symptoms reduce the severity and length of illness. Now that's good news. At 7 days, more of the patients who took zinc remedies every couple of hours during the daytime had cleared their symptoms compared to those who took placebos. And children who took 15 milligrams of zinc syrup or zinc lozenges daily for 5 months or longer caught fewer colds and took less time off of school, which is good. But the 15 trials in the review all use different treatment time scales and doses, making it impossible to reach a consensus. And the people who use zinc also reported more side effects, such as an unpleasant aftertaste or nausea, than the placebo group did. Editor-in-chief of the Cochrane Library, David Tovey, said, "This is a treatment that is showing some promise, which, where treating the common cold is concerned, is unusual. Although there are many over-the-counter cold remedies, although readily available, we are not awash with things that can stop cold symptoms or greatly reduce their severity. Now, there is still an uncertainty about the best doses, timings, and formulations, and more studies will be needed to look at this." Professor Ronald Eccles, director of the Common Cold Center at Cardiff University, remained doubtful about zinc's benefits as a cold treatment in current formulations. He said zinc's toxicity would also be a potential concern if taken over longer periods. And we will keep you updated on any information that comes floating out of that research. Now, how about a glass of red wine? It can help cancer drugs be more effective. A glass of red wine for women with breast cancer could boost the success rate of treatment. The ingredient resveratrol, which occurs naturally in red wine, enhances the effects of a drug used to combat the disease. Laboratory tests found the ingredient can prevent cancer cells from developing resistance to the drug called rapamycin. Now, although cancer trials show the drug works against tumors, the cells start to grow again after resistance sets in. Resveratrol is a potent antioxidant produced by plants such as grapes, raspberries, cranberries, and peanuts to fight off fungal and bacterial infections. Scientists have been exploring its potential in reducing the risk of heart disease, Alzheimer's, and even the aging process. But they have now discovered that the plant chemical, which gives red wine its color, can make cancer drugs even more effective. Professor Charles Eng of Cleveland Clinic's Lerner Research Institute in Ohio said rapamycin has been used in clinical trials as a cancer treatment. Unfortunately, after a while, the cancer treatments develop resistance to rapamycin. Our findings show that resveratrol seems to mitigate rapamycin-induced drug resistance in breast cancers, at least in the laboratory. Now, her team studied the effect of combining resveratrol with rapamycin on breast cancer cells. Now, their findings published in Cancer Letters demonstrates an additive effect between the two components on suppressing breast cancer cell signaling and growth. Breast cancer is the most common type of cancer among women, and almost 45,000 cases are diagnosed in the UK every year. Previous research has suggested a glass of red wine a day can protect against breast cancer because resveratrol blocks the way oestrogen combines with DNA in a woman's body. Resveratrol has also been linked to an anti-aging property situation. The antioxidant is one of a number of so-called healthy chemicals found in red wine called polyphenols. The latest research also indicates a tumor-suppressing gene known as PTEN is activated by resveratrol. Professor Eng said further testing was needed in patients, but added that the ingredient could also be found in a variety of foods. She said that if these observations hold true in the clinical setting, then enjoying a glass of red wine or eating a bowl of boiled peanuts, which has a higher resveratrol content than red wine, before rapamycin treatment for cancer might be a prudent approach. Now, rapamycin was discovered on Easter Island in the 1970s, produced from a fungus made by insects and originally used to prevent rejection in organ transplant patients. It has only been recently considered as a weapon against breast cancer, but despite the potential for tumor suppression, rapamycin has produced uneven responses in limiting growth of various breast cancer cell lines. In the latest test, the effect of resveratrol and rapamycin alone and in combination on cell growth of of 3 human breast cancer cell lines was assessed. Rapamycin, resveratrol, and combinations of these agents all inhibited cell growth, with higher doses proving more effective. But even low concentrations of resveratrol and rapamycin were sufficient to induce 50% inhibition in growth in each of these cell lines. Now, although relatively early, these observations may suggest resveratrol as a powerful integrative medicine in addition to traditional chemotherapy, said Professor Eng. Resveratrol is also available in supplement form, but this has not been tested in cancer trials. So in higher doses, it causes side effects such as insomnia, joint pain, diarrhea, and acne. More research is needed on this. More research will be reported on this show. I have it on my alert. And speaking of foods, a new hybrid drug derived from a common spice may protect, rebuild brain cells after strokes. Whether or not you're fond of Indian, Southeast Asian, and Middle Eastern food, stroke researchers at Cedars-Sinai Medical Center think you may become a fan of one of their key spices. The scientists created a new molecule from curcumin, a chemical component of its golden-colored spice turmeric, found in laboratory experiments that it affects mechanisms that protect and help regenerate brain cells after a stroke. Research scientist Paul A. Lapchak, PhD, Director of Translational Research in the Department of Neurology at Cedars-Sinai Medical Center, presented these findings at the American Heart Association International Stroke Conference in Los Angeles on Wednesday, February 9, 2011. Only one drug is now approved for ischemic stroke, which occurs when a clot blocks blood flow to the brain. Commonly called a clot-busting drug, tissue plasminogen activator, TPA, is injected intravenously to dissolve clots and reinstate blood flow. If blood and oxygen are restored in time, consequences of the stroke, such as speech, memory, movement, and other impairments, may be reduced. The new curcumin hybrid compound, called CNB-001, does not attack but instead repair stroke damage at the molecular level that feed and support the all-important brain cells, neurons. Curcumin has been studied for its potential to treat brain injury and disease, and while the substance itself looks promising, it has several drawbacks, especially as an emergency stroke treatment, which must be quick to be effective. Now, it's not well absorbed in the body. It fails to reach its target at high concentrations and becomes depleted quickly and is blocked from entering the brain by a natural protective mechanism called the blood-brain barrier. CNB-001 has many of the same benefits of curcumin, but appears to be a better choice of compound for acute stroke because it crosses the blood-brain barrier and is quickly distributed in the brain. It moderates several critical mechanisms involved in the neuronal survival. Lapchak said this, adding that he and his colleagues expect the new drug to move to human clinical trials pretty soon. Now, when the brain tissue is deprived of blood and oxygen, a cascading series of interrelated events triggers at the molecular level, breaking down the normal electrical and chemical signaling pathways responsible for nourishing and supporting neurons. Now, the environment quickly becomes toxic, killing brain cells and destroying their support structures. Theoretically, interrupting these harmful events and restoring normal pathway function could prevent cell death and the memory and behavioral deficits that could result from this, but it would also take a cocktail of drugs or a drug capable of targeting many mechanisms to correct the many pathways damaged by stroke, Lapchak says. CNB-001 protects brain cells from damage by repairing 4 major pathways. One mechanism also plays a major role in the growth and survival of neurons. The drug reduced stroke caused motor deficits, problems of muscle and movement control in this laboratory study. This was effective when administered up to an hour after the stroke, which correlates with about 3 hours in humans and the same time frame for which TPA is currently approved. Lapchak and colleagues at the Salk Institute for Biological Studies used the same lab rabbit model to mimic human stroke that earlier researchers had employed before the clot-busting drug TPA entered the clinical trials. Patrick D. Leiden, MD, chairman of Cedars-Sinai Department of neurology, helped lead a major trial that resulted in the Food and Drug Administration's 1996 approval of TPA, still considered the stroke treatment gold standard. Now, those who cook Indian, Thai, Malay, and Persian dishes know turmeric well for its zesty flavor, use in curries, and for the rich color it imparts to food. Turmeric has a long history use in Ayurvedic and Chinese traditional medicine. Most of this information was provided by Cedars-Sinai Medical Center, and you can look that up on their website. Now listen to this. The FDA is going to test brain-controlled prosthetic arms. This system, using a brain-implanted microchip, is meant to provide a near-natural functioning of the arm, hand, and fingers. Yes, this is kind of like the bionic man. This prosthesis will be evaluated in a new FDA program that gives priority review to breakthrough medical devices. The Food and Drug Administration will evaluate brain-controlled prosthetic arms in a new program designed to bring innovative medical devices to the market faster. The new arm system, developed by Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, uses a microchip implanted in the brain to record and decode signals to neurons that control muscles linked to prosthesis. No, this is not a TV show starring Lee Majors. This is real life. The device is intended to restore near-natural arm, hand, and finger function to patients suffering from spinal cord injury, stroke, or amputation, according to an FDA press release on Tuesday morning. Now, the prosthesis will serve as a pilot submission to the FDA's Innovation Pathway, a priority review program for new breakthrough medical devices that is part of a broader effort to promote cutting-edge technologies among medical device manufacturers. Each year, millions of American patients benefit from innovative medical devices that reduce suffering and treat previously untreatable conditions. Jeffrey Schurin, director of FDA's Medical Office Device Office, said, "Now, the innovation initiative, quote, will help accelerate the development of and patient access to innovative medical devices, which often fulfill unmet public health needs," unquote. FDA and DARPA had a meeting yesterday and briefed on these details, and you can look that up on their websites. They were explaining the new device and the government's efforts to encourage innovation. And as we see every single week on this show, is life imitating art or art imitating life? Well, science fiction is usually ending up to be science fact if you wait long enough. Prison guards could soon stop fights with a harmless tool that shoots a laser-like beam, video game style, into a room where trouble is brewing. The Assault Intervention Device, AID, funded by the National Institute of Justice, is still large and unrefined, but will soon be installed for trial in at least one prison, the Pitchless Detention Center in Los Angeles County. The aid directs an energy beam, which is the invisible millimeter wavelength. It penetrates just deep enough beneath the skin to make the target's pain receptors shout. The sensation is a burn like touching perhaps a hot stove or an iron. It lasts up to 3 seconds. The AID controls automatically shut the beam off to prevent shooting for longer without resetting the trigger finger. Now, the beam can hit a target about 100 feet away, and this is about as wide as a CD. According to Raytheon, the device's manufacturers, it causes no actual damage to nerves or skin. This video that they have put out called New Laser Weapon Debuts in LA County Jail, you can look that up on YouTube, shows a sharp reflex caused by an AID hit and the unscathed hit receivers. Okay, so it shows basically, you know, the beam hitting them and what they feel and any sustained damage, if any, shown, which was none. So if you watch, you probably also noticed how big and clunky this device is. It's gigantic, and indeed it stands at 7.5 feet tall and is controlled by joysticks. The shooter arm uses a computer screen linked to the device. It seems like it would be an easy transition from Xbox user to aid shooter. So I guess those are some skills that you might have got when you were sitting at home and tired of watching network TV. Though it's better than the current options, batons or pepper spray, Commander Bob Osborne of the LA County Sheriff's Department tells Tech News Daily that its efficacy still needs to be proven in real assault situations before anyone should bother making it smaller and easier to use. I wonder if it could be eventually become a handheld device and compete with tasers. Of course, we all know the effects of tasers. No thanks. But if you're a criminal and they need to control the situation, of course, that is one of their tools of the trade. Now, speaking of invisible, we've talked very many times on very many of these reports about invisibility cloaks and devices. And, of course, we did have this fantastic report coming out of Duke University's Pratt School of Engineering, which demonstrated the first working invisibility cloak. This cloak deflects microwave beams so they flow around a hidden object inside with little distortion, making it appear almost as if nothing were there at all. Now, Michio Kaku has a little bit to say about this and some of the report from the Duke University itself. Next, stay tuned.
If I was invisible, could you see me?
No, by definition. And 2 years ago, we thought it was impossible to get invisibility. In fact, in my optics class at the university, I would tell my students, it's impossible for light to bend around an object, reform at the other end. Well, I was wrong. Every
Really?
Single physics textbook on the planet Earth is wrong. 2 years ago, it was done at Duke University. With microwave radiation, they took an object, they showed that you can bend microwaves around an object, have it reform on the other side as if it's not there at all. And then at Caltech, just 6 months ago, we did it with visible light. Now think about that. We can now take, in principle, an object and make it disappear, just like in the movies. So Harry Potter, watch out.
The invisibility cloak is a real thing that's going to happen?
A cloak is hard. However, we do think that an invisibility cylinder is possible within a few decades.
That's not as sexy as the cloak.
Hey, you know, get used to it. This is physics we're talking about. This is reality. A cylinder, you could put a soldier inside.
Right.
And, of course, guess who's funding this research? The Pentagon. The Pentagon is not stupid. They know the enormous advantage if you have invisible soldiers, invisible helicopters, and what have you. If you have a cylinder, the person inside will be invisible because light will wrap around it like water going around a boulder. Downstream from a boulder, you have no inkling that there's a boulder upstream because water has reformed on the other side. Now, there's some problems, because Harry Potter in the inside of the cylinder has to look outside. You have to cut two holes in your cylinder. So from the outside, you see two floating eyeballs. That's a dead giveaway.
Duke University scientists successfully tested a cloak of invisibility. Their prototype cloak mostly hid a small metal cylinder from passing microwaves.
When you think of cloaking or invisibility, you think of making something vanish. And usually you think of it optically vanishing, or you look at something and then it's gone. And right now, we don't know how to do that. This is just a simple example where you can take one wavelength, or for example, one color, and you could achieve cloaking of that color.
This cloak guides electromagnetic waves around a central region so that any object at all can be placed in that region and will not disturb the electromagnetic fields. So there's reduced reflection from the object, and there's also a reduced shadow that you would normally expect to see from electromagnetic waves impinging on an object.
David Smith has built an apparatus in the laboratory that essentially enables you to map the distribution of electromagnetic fields around an object, so you can literally see the radio waves, in this case, traveling towards the object, bending around that object, and passing through the object.
In their experiment, the scientists first measured microwaves passing over a plane without any obstacles. Then they placed a copper cylinder in the plane and measured the disturbance in the microwaves. Next, they placed the invisibility cloak over the copper cylinder. The cloak did not completely return the microwaves to their undisturbed state, but it did greatly reduce the microwaves being blocked or reflected. The results are published online in the journal Science. The key to the cloak's invisibility is the arrangement of copper lines on fiberglass sheets. The design gives the cloak electromagnetic properties different from those of pure copper or fiberglass. The design comes out of the new engineering science of metamaterials.
Metamaterials are materials that are structured by taking macroscopic elements and fashioning them or patterning them together to make a material that is unlike any material that you could synthesize naturally. As an application, it's not clear that you're going to get the invisibility that everyone thinks about as in Harry Potter's cloak or the Star Trek cloaking device. But it shows what can be done with artificial materials. It gives us some insight that we can design something that we wouldn't have been able to do with any existing material.
This experiment is really just a tiny baby step towards demonstrating that this sort of thing is feasible. Obviously, everybody can come up with a whole set of interesting things one might be able to do if you can make something invisible. And all of those are, at this point, in play, given the theory that has been developed to support this work.
And speaking of unseen things, bee sensors pick up queen bees' farewell vibes. Time for a new hive. The accelerometers that detect motion in smartphones have been turned into listening devices for predicting when a queen honeybee will desert her old hive, an event known as swarming. Swarming can be bad news for beekeepers. When a queen bee departs, she takes half the hive with her, leaving a weaker hive behind. With advance warning, it's possible to set up a bait hive to lure in the departing bees. But if the events are not managed properly, swarming can mean half the hive is lost entirely. Martin Bensick's team at Nottingham Trent University, UK, embedded accelerometers into the back wall of two hives to detect the motion caused by the buzzing insects. They hooked their sensors up to a computer to monitor changes in the hive's vibrations over 5 months. The method relies on the computer learning the language of the buzzing hive, says Bensick. Now, the team found several signals in the vibrations. For instance, vibrations peak at sunrise, which could be used to monitor the health of a colony. Crucially, about 10 days before swarming, the hives produced a distinct vibration. Others have tried to monitor hives using microphones and without much success, I might add, but Bensick's device would be useful if he could prove it works on a large scale, says Tim Levitt of the British Beekeepers Association, which has considered developing a similar one that would automatically deliver an alert by phone or email for existence before a hive swarms. Bencic and his team now intend to expand the study. If we want to see if each hive has its own language, he says, created by different hive structures or bee species, the clincher would be whether his computer program can learn each of these languages and deliver reliable alerts. Well, there's a great marriage of technology, organisms, and the environment for the better. And it's about time for me to buzz right out of here. Speaking of that, I'd like to thank Nick Palucco for the great show graphics. I'd like to thank Dennis Baum for that wonderful intro I use every single week, and his company, Hawk Productions. And a special shout out to Todd Sheets, who makes sure that my audio is not a piece of garbage every week when you listen. Hopefully it's not. Anyway, I guess I'm responsible for the content, eh? Have a wonderful week. Keep your powder in your pants dry, and happy trails until we meet again.
Cherry pie, yet there she was. like disco superfly. I smell sex and candy hair. Who's that lounging in my chair? Who's that casting the fear stares in my direction? Mama, this surely is a dream. Yeah, yeah, mama, this surely. Disco lemonade. Yeah. I smell sex and candlelit hair. Who's that lounging in my chair? Who's that casting devious stares in my direction? Mama, this surely is a dream. Casting devious stares in my direction.